This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. So sit back with your cup of coffee, but if you're driving, just listen to the radio as you drive along and we'll talk about special topics of interest in estate planning, tax, business planning, and other areas, including the special guests who bring their special spin on what they've done as entrepreneurs, business owners, financial advisors, and the like, to tell you about their story, which is always an interesting addition to our knowledge base to find out about other people and how they achieve success. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a full-service law firm located in Fairfax serving the entire D.C. metro area with clients all across the country. If you'd like to know more about us, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com. And I also invite you to subscribe to my blog at blueprintforwealth.org, where you can find video, audio, and articles of interest on tax, estate planning, and business planning topics of interest. And lastly, please read my column in the Washington Business Journal every month entitled Blueprint for Wealth. Today, we're going to be talking about a checklist of things that you need to be aware of and you need to do when you start up and incorporate your business. Forming a new corporation or limited liability company requires careful planning and a number of key steps. So let's focus on that checklist of important issues to address. First, choose a corporate name or your LLC name. It's not easy because many names are already taken and some names may have trademark limitations associated with them. Check out the name, see if it's available at the Secretary of State in the state in which you want to incorporate. That's the first step. Second, reserve it if it is available. Third, do a Google search and even do an online trademark search with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to see if somebody is already using the name. And if they're not, try to reserve it and get up and operating as soon as possible. You may even want to trademark the name. Number two, decide what state you're going to set up your business in. What state will you incorporate in? We've all heard that Delaware and Nevada tout their corporation-friendly state laws, but you may decide that the state in which you reside and will conduct your business primarily is the place that you want to incorporate. Number three, start having an attorney prepare the incorporation documents. Now, some of our clients prefer to do it themselves. And if you're going to operate a one-man band or a one-person band so that you're the only owner and you're really not going to ever have any other owners and you're just trying to achieve liability protection, you may be able to do so on your own using one of the online services. It usually means preparing articles of incorporation or articles of organization. For corporations, you also need bylaws, and you'll probably need to have organizational minutes or resolutions of your board of directors and your shareholders. You also will need a stock ledger, which records the issuance of stock that you're going to make upon opening the company, stock certificates for corporations, and more. Number four, file your articles of incorporation or articles of organization for LLCs with your Secretary of State in the state of incorporation. It's required to officially start your business and achieve limited liability protection. Number five, determine the right capitalization for your company. You may want to make sure that you've adequately capitalized the company to ensure its success. I'm not only talking about the number of shares you're going to issue to yourself or other shareholders on incorporation. I'm talking about how much money you should permanently devote to the capital of the company. You need to consider the capital needs of the company and do it through a well-thought-out business plan and even financial projections. It doesn't have to be sophisticated. It doesn't have to be acceptable to third-party investors unless you're going out and selling stock to those investors. It needs to be well thought out for yourself, because whenever you open a business, you don't just want to do it and not really know where you're headed. A business plan is a direction in which you're going to be heading, and it gives you the ability to focus on achieving goals and a strategy to achieve those goals. The capitalization that falls out from that says, I need to have a certain amount of capital permanently devoted to the business so that I can continue to operate if revenue is not coming in and continue to pay my expenses. Number six, once you've determined the right capitalization and your capital structure, and going to an attorney and an accountant will be helpful in this regard, issue stock to your shareholders and make sure that you comply with the securities laws when you're doing so. When you sell stock to a shareholder, you have to be aware that anytime you do that, even if it's a small company, you have to comply with state and federal securities laws. There's an overriding provision of securities laws that says your sale of stock must be done in a way that you've disclosed all the material facts relating to your business and you haven't omitted any material facts when you're making those disclosures. As long as you do that and you basically articulate what the risks of investing in your corporation are, then you will have complied with federal securities laws and you'll avoid liability under the anti-fraud statutes. A good corporate lawyer can help you navigate through the stock issuance process. If you're just issuing the stock to yourself, you don't have to be as cognizant of these laws. But anytime you're issuing stock to a third party, you definitely need to be aware of it. Number seven, if you're going to have more than one owner or more than one shareholder, you need to think about and very seriously think about whether or not you need a shareholders agreement for a corporation or an operating agreement for your company, limited liability company. On top of that, you may, in addition, need a buy-sell agreement. These agreements regulate corporate governance among the shareholders in terms of what decisions they may or may not participate in. They also deal with what happens if you die or become disabled, or another shareholder dies or becomes disabled, or if they leave the employment of the company, or if you can terminate them for any reason or for cause, and what your rights are as the majority owner of the company vis-a-vis the minority owners of the company. So these are really important agreements that need to be entered into if you're going to have two or more shareholders or owners. In a corporation, make sure you have a corporate minute book. Now, various corporate actions require documentation. In a corporation, you're going to have shareholders and a board of directors. There are some exceptions to that rule for close corporations in certain states, but the general rule is shareholders have to vote on certain actions and board of directors have to vote on virtually all material actions affecting the company. The board is comprised, perhaps, of the same people who are the shareholders, but they are separate and distinct from each other. The board is charged with operating the day-to-day business of the company, and directors owe a fiduciary duty to the corporation and to the shareholders to act prudently, with loyalty, and with care in operating the business of the company. So in having a corporate minute book, you will document the minutes and consents and the resolutions of the board of directors and also the shareholders, and you'll keep that on display and available for shareholder review from time to time. Next, number nine, elect the officers of your company. Depending on your state, you may need more than one director. So the shareholders elect the directors, and the directors turn around and elect the officers. In most states, one person can hold more than one position. So if you're the sole shareholder and you're the sole member of the board of directors, you can also serve as the president and secretary and treasurer, usually, of your company. You may appoint a non-shareholder or a non-director in an officer capacity. It happens all the time, and as the company gets bigger, that's the norm. Next, don't forget to get your state and federal ID numbers. The federal tax ID number can be obtained online generally or by fax. But in the state, you may have a specific registration number, and you'll have to fill out certain forms, or your attorney or accountant can assist you in filling out these forms to get these numbers. Number 11, and very important, a lot of people forget about this, is determine if you need any special licenses for your businesses. State, federal, or local rules may require your business to get a special business license. For example, if you're going to do engineering, you have to get a special license. If you're going to do construction of any kind, commercial or residential, you have to get certain types of contractors' licenses in order to do business. Next, number 12, set up your corporate bank account. You could do it where you personally bank, or you may want to do it at a separate institution. But you always need to have a separate bank account, separate and apart from your personal bank account, for your corporation or your limited liability company. This is important in observing the formalities of your business, and it's important in avoiding creditors from trying to pierce through your corporate veil to go after your personal assets. So having that corporate bank account set up in the corporate name with resolutions adopting the bank as the depository company are really important steps in setting up your company. Number 13, if you're going to hire employees, make sure you have all of the forms and agreements for them. For example, one of the things that people forget is that every time you hire an employee, they have to fill out an I-9, which is from the Department of Immigration, and it discloses whether or not they are U.S. citizens and provides evidence of their citizenship. In addition, the agreement might include an at-will employment letter or employment agreement saying that either the employee or the employer can terminate the business relationship at any time. It should include a confidentiality and invention assignment agreement. This will ensure that any intellectual property that you have the employee develop for you as the employer in connection with their job will be owned by the company. And lastly, an employment application, giving you permission to conduct a background check and anything else that you need to do. Last, consider electing S corporation status, which will be the subject of another radio show in the future. If you've got questions about incorporating your business or setting up a limited liability company, call us at 703-218-2100. I'm Wayne Zell, and you're listening to Blueprint for Wealth.
You're listening to Blueprint for Wealth with Wayne Zell. Learn how to better prepare for your future when Blueprint for Wealth returns in a moment.
A Legal Minute with Wayne Zell.
What does an employer have to do before hiring an employee? Besides federal and state laws that prohibit discrimination in the workplace and mandate standards for worker safety, employers have to fulfill several basic requirements before employing workers. They must determine if the worker is an employee or an independent contractor. Issues such as tax withholding from employee paychecks and liability may be implicated by this decision. They should also use federal and state guidelines to determine whether workers are in fact employees. Employers should obtain federal and state employer ID numbers, which are used for tax purposes. Depending on the state, employers may also be required to participate in a workers' compensation insurance pool and obtain an unemployment and compensation identification number. Some states may have additional requirements for employers, so employers may want to consult with an experienced employment law attorney to ensure compliance with federal and state law.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. If you have questions for Wayne, you can email him at radio@ofplaw.com or call him at 703-218-2100. Now back to your host, Wayne Zell.
Welcome back to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, and with me today is my special guest, Kim Natovitz. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you on the show. Kim brings 20-plus years of experience advising clients and financial advisors about insurance planning. She partners with financial planners, lawyers, accountants, and trust companies, as well as individuals and employers. And due to her expertise, many of us ask Kim to help them personally select the right insurance products. She was one of the earliest insurance advisors to recognize the importance of advising clients and professionals about the need to plan for extended care. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in length today. The relationships she's developed with insurance carriers, care managers and providers have earned her a reputation as one of the most knowledgeable professionals in the industry. She's been recognized by several local publications as one of the best insurance advisors in our area, and Kim is a current board member of the Washington Area Women's Foundation. She and her husband reside in Maryland and have 5-year-old twins.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. What brought you to D.C. and how long ago was that?
You know, I came to D.C. probably about 22 years ago and accepted a job with an insurance company to open an office here. And my role was to help property and casualty agents sell retirement plans to their clients.
Okay.
And it was a great opportunity.
And so you've been here ever since. And what made you decide to open your own insurance agency?
You know, I decided that as much as retirement planning was really interesting and compelling, because it was at the time we were really making the shift from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans.
Right.
There was a tremendous amount of education that pre-retirees needed about saving and investing for their own future.
Right.
But it was really my passion for something that nobody else was talking about, which was this need for extended care. And I'd had a tremendous amount of family experience. We always joke and say I'm the poster child for, you know, for long-term care. You know, I grew up with my grandfather living with us and being responsible for taking care of him. My father's mother was in a nursing home for over 11 years. And I saw the toll that it took on our family, both emotionally and financially,
right,
for them to be responsible for taking care of their parents later on in life. Then when I got married, I saw my mother-in-law go through a similar experience of needing care. And again, saw what happened in their family and to my sister-in-law and my husband, and recognized this was something that people really weren't talking about. And it was such an important component of long-term financial security.
You know, the passion that you show me about, you know, educating people is really an important component of being a good advisor in any industry. When did you first realize, was it the family experience that really turned you on to the need to educate others about the benefits of long-term care insurance?
It was absolutely the family experience, because nobody was prepared.
Right.
You know, we were all concerned about having sufficient income for retirement, but nobody was really focusing on these healthcare costs,
right,
how expensive they could be, how you could need this type of care immediately, and it could go on for a number of years, and that you could end up, while you'd accumulated for retirement, you might end up invading principal very early on and spending your 401k, as an example, twice as fast as you'd ever anticipated.
What does, you know, we all know that Medicare is out there, and we have Medicaid, which is really for the indigent.
Right.
What do they pay for? What does Medicare pay for, and what doesn't it pay for?
That's a great question. You know, Medicare is really designed to pay for skilled care, something where it's anticipated that you're going to recover and be able to live independently. So Medicare is going to pay for the time that you spend in a nursing home when you can't receive that care on an outpatient basis.
Okay.
You know, Medicare ostensibly will pay for up to 100 days of skilled care. Although what I see is that most people aren't responding. At some point in time, Medicare comes in and says, you're not making any further improvements, so we're not even going to pay for 100 days of skilled care. And that's a huge surprise to a lot of families.
Who makes that determination? Somebody in the government?
The decision is made essentially by whoever is managing that plan of care and looking at, is increased skilled care, PTOT, going to render you more functionally independent? And oftentimes it isn't. And what people are often surprised about is that Medicare really does not pay for any care at home, and it doesn't pay for care that is purely custodial. So that person who ends up going into a nursing home, and they're going to that nursing home because of Alzheimer's or dementia or something, where they haven't had that skilled care or that three-day hospital stay, Medicare's not going to participate in their care at all. So there are really very limited benefits from Medicare.
What about Medicaid? Does that pay for anything?
You know, Medicaid absolutely will pay for care. However, for most of us, first, it's not going to pay for the care where we want to receive it. So Medicaid is going to pay for care in a facility, assuming you meet the criteria and that you have declined sufficiently and you really need to receive your care in that setting. So Medicaid does not pay for home care. And the way that you qualify for Medicaid is if your income, your assets are not sufficient to pay for your care, then Medicaid looks at your financial situation and they determine, you know, of your Social Security and whatever income you have, this is how much you pay to the facility, and then Medicaid will pay the balance. But the difficulty is, especially for people who are married. So Medicaid is going to say that, you know, for a spouse, we are going to leave you with some resources. And there is, on a state-by-state basis, you know, an asset limit and an income limit. But it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's certainly not going to be enough for most people to have the type of financial security or lifestyle that they had prior to someone needing care.
In other words, unless you're indigent, Medicaid is really not an option.
Absolutely.
Now, can you tell us how long-term care insurance works? Just give us an example of how it works.
Sure. You know, long-term care insurance often is very confusing to people, but it really is relatively simple, because long-term care insurance, there are really two types. It's nothing more than a supplemental health insurance contract. And it's a health insurance contract that's going to pay for what's specifically excluded from Medicare, our employer-sponsored health insurance plans, Medicare supplements. So you're essentially purchasing either a traditional health insurance policy, or you're buying a life insurance policy with a long-term care rider, an annuity contract with a long-term care rider, where you're selecting first a daily benefit or a monthly benefit. And that's how much the insurance company is going to reimburse you for care in the setting of your choice, in your home or in a facility. And then you're determining how long do you want those benefits to continue, a number of years, a number of months. Then you're determining, do you want those benefits to increase so that if it's a decade or longer before you need care, you have a benefit that is increased for inflation.
With all the increases in healthcare costs, that would be a wise thing to do if you're buying long-term care insurance.
Absolutely.
I'm going to throw a zinger at you, because I've heard from other people who are in the insurance industry that long-term care insurance is not long for this world, that the providers are stopping, you know, the provision of long-term care insurance. It's not as available. The policies are being redone. What's going on in the industry today? Can you give us sort of a quick synopsis of that?
Sure, absolutely. I think there are a number of carriers that are, well, first let me step back and tell you a little bit about money for claims. And that comes from premiums that people pay, and it comes from the carriers investing those premiums and what they earn on there. So in this very low interest rate environment, I don't know if you've been to a bank recently and, you know, went to open a CD, but you probably spent more on gas than you're going to earn on interest. So insurance,
for the whole year.
Yeah, for the whole year.
Right.
So insurance companies are really suffering in terms of what they can earn on their investments. And long-term care insurance is a contract where there are a lot of reserves that are required. So there have been some carriers that have looked at essentially the resources they have to deploy, the return on the investment, and they have decided that if this is such a small piece of the pie for us, it's not worth it for us to continue to sell this contract and to really tie up these resources. So some carriers have made that decision that this is just not a business we want to be in, that we would actually improve profitability by selling more of additional profit lines from there. There have been some carriers that have said, we thought we would cross-sell more. we thought more of our existing clients would purchase this product when in fact it, you know, it hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then the initial assumptions that carriers made with regard to this product have turned out to not be what current experience reflects. And so carriers who really don't have a substantial amount of market share have decided that this is a product that carriers are going to need more experience to price appropriately. And if they're not a carrier that already has a lot of market share, it's just not something that they've continued to be worthwhile for them. Now, carriers have also taken the tact of inventing or essentially looking at new products that some consumers find more attractive. And these are the life insurance products, the annuity products that have long-term care riders.
Okay.
Because something that consumers have said is that while we want this benefit, we don't necessarily want to pay this premium and not get anything in return. So there's been a new generation of products to complement the existing products.
So and to make a two-minute answer, a 10-second answer, it's still available and people should consider buying it.
Still available, not going away.
Okay. If I've got enough assets to pay for my care, why should I buy long-term care insurance?
That's a great question. Well, the first thing is, you know, assets are not what pays for long-term care. It's income. And not all of our assets necessarily produce income. And then if we're in a situation where if we look at 2008 and we didn't have sufficient income necessarily to cover the cost of care, if we had to liquidate an asset, we might be taking a significant market value adjustment. We end up reducing our income. We may lose a stepped up basis on an asset. I think the other reasons that people buy long-term care is for estate conservation. They don't necessarily want to use their assets to pay for care. We also look at the demographics of families today. And so we're looking at people who are marrying later in life. They are having children. Maybe they've been married previously. And as part of an overall estate planning strategy to make sure that beneficiaries receive assets, it can be something that makes sense.
What are the biggest mistakes that people make when they're buying long-term care insurance?
I think one of the biggest mistakes that people make is often over-insuring the benefit period, but not buying a high enough monthly benefit.
What do you mean by that?
So many people initially bought long-term care benefits with a lifetime unlimited benefit period.
Okay.
But they bought a policy that didn't really cover enough of what their expenses were.
Right.
And so they really were overinsured in terms of the, you know, the benefit period there. Second thing is not buying an inflation rider.
Oh, my.
So bought long-term care insurance when they were in their 50s, but by the time they got to be in their 70s and long-term care costs had increased, they really didn't have enough benefit from there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the last issue is not telling anybody what they did or why they did it and not having a plan that addresses, you know, the who, what, when, where for actually helping them to implement a plan of care.
We're talking with Kim Natovitz, who obviously is an expert in long-term care insurance. Kim, if people want to get in touch with you to find out about the options that they have for long-term care insurance and other insurance products, how do they do that?
One of two ways. They can call my office, and our number is 301-581-7333, or they can send us an email, knatovitz, K-N-A-T-O-V-I-T-Z, at natovitz, N-A-T-O-V-I-T-Z .com.
What a great explanation of long-term care insurance, and I encourage the listeners out there to call Kim, send her an email, get in touch with her through her website to find out more about long-term care insurance. Thanks for being a special guest on Blueprint for Wealth.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to our topics and guests. Join us next week for another special topic and special guest on Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell. Have a great week.
You've been listening to Wayne Zell and Blueprint for Wealth. Wayne will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. with your Blueprint for Wealth right here on 1500 a.m.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting.